You only feel bad because you work with two flawless broadcasters.
That's right.
You can't live up to the standard that Elliot and I set. All right, Elliot, just going over my notes here. Plenty to get to on this week's edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. We should probably talk about a really nice piece that you did talking about the ownership group of the Ottawa Senators and their counterparts with the San Jose Sharks and helping to facilitate the Erik Karlsson trade. We should probably talk a little bit about a really nice exchange you had with Kevin Bieksa.
Mm-hmm.
He continues to impress with his razor-sharp wit.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we have a loaf of bread here. Kevin, can you come over and cut it with your razor-sharp wit, please? I liked your piece on John McFarland. We'll get there. We'll talk about the captaincy going from McKenzie to Barkov. We should probably also talk about primary colors we saw last night between Nashville and Carolina. Second time, by the way, Carolina's done that in the preseason. But let's start with the biggest story in the NHL today, and that is...
Gritty. There's nothing that's happened in this league that's made as much conversation as Gritty has in Philadelphia.
All right. Okay, first of all, I love the fact that it seems that every time I look on social media, Philadelphia is doubling down on this.
Yes.
To the point where I like it now. Initially, nope, wasn't for me, and now I love it.
Well, it's very Philly, right? Like, you don't like this? Like, screw you. Like, it's very Philly.
If you're not sure of something, say it loud.
Yeah.
Which is a philosophy I believe in.
But that's Philly, right? Like, yeah. We're a tough town. You don't like us? Too bad. You know, honestly, I got to tell you, Jeff, when I first saw it, I said, is this like a goof on the president?
Oh, you thought it was a Trump rip?
I did.
Really?
I thought it was like a goof on the president.
I thought it looked like
president.
Animal from the Muppet Show until I saw Carlin Bathe on Twitter say, oh, it's my dad, Frank Bathe.
That was funny. But like, I didn't think of Animal. That was the first thing I thought of. It was like a goof on the president. And then I was like, you can't be serious. Like, they're not really going to do this, right?
Oh, yeah.
And you're right. They are refusing to back down. It is really something.
In for a penny, in for a pound. The Philadelphia Flyers on their mascot. I love it. It's almost like they're going to just jam it down everyone's throats. You don't like it? Too bad. Here's two servings now. I respect that.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going to make a decision.
Don't back down.
If you're going to get into the batter's box, dig in, right? Plant your back foot and swing.
Well, because, you know, how many people now back down from something because of the social media reaction?
Happens all the time.
People are afraid. People get talked out of things that are fine all the time because they're afraid of the reaction. I do have an admiration for that too, that they're looking at this and they're saying, too bad.
You ever done anything on mascots in 31 Thoughts? Here's why I ask. When I was doing Marley's games with John Bartlett, now Leafs voice on Sportsnet, so Duke the Dog was the mascot. And the guy that originally played Duke, wonderful guy, young guy, kids loved him, had like, you know, certain kids that would come up to him all the time, do handshakes, high fives, had like little routines at the rink. I think he did the job for 2 years and then moved on to a higher position. I think he stayed at Maple Leaf Sports Entertainment. I'm not sure. But anyway, so then a new Duke came in and one parent, Marley's game, I'm leaving, was after a game, I think it was against Milwaukee. And she pulls me aside. She said, my son's really upset at Duke the Dog. And I'm like, am I really having a conversation about how a kid's upset about a mascot? Like, I can't remember who ended up being Duke. Like, well, what happened? And she said, you know, we came to the games all last year, and every game he would do a certain kind of high five with Duke the Dog, and they'd do like head noogies or something. And now this year, he won't even acknowledge my kid. Like, what's got into your mascot this year? And it was only at that point that I realized, like, for kids, mascots are a big deal.
Yeah.
And when you have something like that, I mean, you're a father, I'm a father, you know how children create bonds with routines.
And the kid's probably looking forward to the game for
totally.
A week.
I get to see Duke the Dog again. This
absolutely.
Is wonderful. And all of a sudden,
it's a good reminder.
Duke's putting up the Heisman here and saying, nope, stop sign. No, I don't know you anymore, kid. And was really traumatized almost by it. That was one of the first things I had my eyes opened about when it came to mascots, at how sensitive you have to be when the person in the costume changes.
Mm-hmm.
You ever do anything on mascots? And
not that
thoughts?
I can remember.
Are you about to do something on mascots?
I don't know.
Can you do an investigative piece on the genesis of Gritty? And can that involve, too, just the etymology of it and how they ended up with that name?
You know what? I think it'll probably be done. I have a feeling it's going to be done by next week, but on the off chance it isn't, you got it.
Anything else on mascots you want to add, or are you just going to start the podcast?
I'm ready to go.
Here we go. 31 Thoughts, the podcast brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Sierra Denali.
Yes, he is. Number 65, Erik Karlsson, in his Sharks debut. And the fans are just realizing who it is as he steps onto the ice. Listen to the crowd. He looks good in that jersey, doesn't he?
I love it. He's got his hands out to the side. Just happened to be here almost saying that to the crowd as they're on their feet now. Erik Karlsson right at the center dot.
I'll tell you what, he's stealth.
Now let's go down to ice level to John Rue.
Territory. So as you can tell, we're super excited for the upcoming season, and we couldn't be more excited that you're a part of the San Jose Sharks. How does it feel to be a Shark?
It feels great. I think, I'm super excited as well. I'm excited to come to a good team, a good crowd, good fan base, and I'm excited to start something new.
All right, welcome to episode 2, season 2, 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Jeff Merrick alongside Elliot Friedman. Still to come, by the way, a very Dallas day today. We have Dallas star Tyler Seguin and Dallas Green, City in Color, Alexis
yes.
on Fire, singer, songwriter, and sports fan extraordinaire, who's been to some pretty key events and knows a lot of pretty cool hockey people as well. So looking forward to that. Meantime, 31 Thoughts on Sportsnet.ca this week. One of the things that caught my mind or caught my eye right away was talking about Eugene Melnyk and how the ownership from the Ottawa Senators working with the ownership from the San Jose Sharks to help facilitate the Erik Karlsson deal. We shouldn't be surprised at this at all, should we? Like normally when big deals like this get done, aren't there at least, conversations from owner to owner? I mean, Gretzky was done, that's Pocklington and McNall.
Yes.
Those aren't GMs to GMs. Those are owners. That's the first big one that we can all recall. But you're saying that ownership was key in getting the Karlsson deal done.
Well, I think there's a couple of things here. First of all, I think you're used to, as I've learned and gotten to know some of the owners, I think most owners will tell you that these are multi-million dollar, if not billion dollar corporations now. So there's a lot more ownership involvement than there ever was. But I think most owners will tell you their preference is to have someone running their team who they trust that they can come to them and say, this is what I'm thinking of doing. Are you okay with it? The biggest thing is, don't surprise me. Like, for example, when the Leafs went out and got Tavares, I don't think ownership was all over that one. I think they went to them with a plan and they said, this is how we're going to do the plan. Ownership said, go for it. I think with this one, they were probably a bit more involved than normal. Now, I know Melnyk and Hasso Plattner, who owns San Jose, they spoke to each other at the beginning of the process. I know that Hasso Plattner twice called Erik and Melinda Karlsson. Once, I believe, when they were in Toronto meeting with the Sharks, and then once again in Ottawa, and I believe he spent an hour on the phone with each of them. That's a lot. Like, for an owner and vet to invest basically 2 to 4 hours with a player like that by phone who's not even their player yet, I think that's a lot. Plattner, by the way, was also part of San Jose's pitch to Tavares. And, I do believe there's been a lot spilling out about the whole Karlsson thing, and it's difficult to tell sometimes exactly what's there. But one thing that I do believe occurred because I checked it is at the end of July, when everything kind of calmed down a bit, Eugene Melnyk emailed Karlsson directly and said, can we meet? And I heard Karlsson was very polite about it. He just said, I'm not ready to decide my future. I don't know when that's going to be, so it's probably not best to meet now.
How do you read then the truth that is Ottawa looking to move Karlsson last year at deadline, fast forwarding to July 1st and a contract
offer
yeah. to the Eugene Melnyk email to the trade between Ottawa and San Jose? It was sort of glossed over in some ways in that Pierre Dorion, or it seemed as if there was a disconnect between he wanted to move on and we had to move on from him, but then why did we offer him a contract?
I think this shows just the overall state of confusion that sometimes comes from Melnick's ownership. I do believe now that if Ottawa could go back, they would have made that deal with Vegas.
At deadline.
And maybe not the deal that was turned down at the end because Bobby Ryan, I think, was still in it. But if they had taken Bobby Ryan out of that deal and traded Carlson to Vegas, I think that would have been their best trade.
And you think hindsight 2020, they would have...
I think...
Considering how
everything played itself out, if you're going to trade Erik Karlsson without Bobby Ryan, then I think you do that at the deadline last year to Vegas, mm-hmm. and you probably get a better deal. I just think Ottawa's philosophy at the top, it changed several times. Back then it was, we want Bobby Ryan to go in a trade with Erik Karlsson. When he got dealt by himself. Mm-hmm. You know, they made the offer, I believe it was 8 times 11. I believe it was 8 years, $88 million. I don't think they ever got into structure or anything like that. It was just like, this is what's going to be on the table. But I don't believe they ever talked about structure or anything like that. But I do believe that Carlson's people felt that that was just like to say that we made the offer. I just think at the end of the day, Carlson didn't believe in the ownership. He was going to go, and they just didn't want it to last into the regular season.
I want to get to San Jose here in a second, but let's pause on Ottawa while we're here. The other headline from this week, Zach Smith.
Yeah.
And the wave. He gets waived. Matt Duchene outspoken about it. This is a kick in the nuts. This is a tough one for our organization.
I think he used the phrase balls.
Apologies. I'll rephrase. This is a kick in the balls for us. Nonetheless, you know, a lot of those players not amused. Mm-hmm. Not exactly a secret. They've, you know, tried to move Zach Smith at various times, I believe, going back to last year's trade deadline.
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
So it shouldn't come as any surprise, but could there not have been another way that this thing was handled?
Well, I think the problem is that they tried to trade him, and there's just not much available right now. And so that's what happens. You know, first of all, I think Ottawa was trying to get rid of the contract. I think also there's a long hangover from what happened last year and the way some of the things that happened in their room. And I wouldn't be surprised if they're completely trying to change it. And you know what? I'm curious to see, honestly, Jeff, is if this is not the last senator with a ticket that we see on waivers. I wonder if either the goalies ends up there, mm-hmm. Anderson or Condon, or another player that they might not be very happy with.
So you think this is everything must go?
This is, we're going to see if we can lighten our cap, yes.
See, I understand, look, this is strictly a business. You know, this isn't, you know, 8 years old wanting to get your name on the Stanley Cup, and this is the hockey business. So I understand it. But what it underscored to me was there's nothing that Ottawa can do that will portray them in a more favorable light, no matter what it is. At this time, that's what it seems. I mean, listen, the Maple Leafs made a decision with Matt Martin. I'm sure that upset a lot of people in that dressing room. Mitch Marner probably one of them. But that's a hockey decision, and they made it. Making the same, a relatively same decision now with Zach Smith by trying to get rid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's met with a thunder of, oh, here we go again, from players and from fans.
Well, you know, this goes back to what we've talked about, and that is that there's no buy-in into the ownership. Like, I think if you were in a vacuum, Jeff, and you knew that you were going for a long rebuild, like Ottawa said, this is going to take 3 years. If you were going into that, I think everybody would understand that. Like, if I had a team, you know, we had a run or whatever, and, you know, guys, we're going to have some pain here as we try to rebuild this. Mm-hmm. I think people would understand that maybe I would try to move a Zach Smith or a player like that on my team. The problem is that it's Ottawa at this time. Like, nobody's buying what they're selling. And everything they do, look, do you think David Amber was going out of his way to embarrass Pierre Dorion on TV last week?
No, not at all.
Not at all. But Dorion paused and thought about his answer. And, you know, people made fun of him on Twitter. It's just because it's Ottawa at this time right now.
Thoughts on Doug Wilson? We talked about him a little bit last week on the podcast. You wrote about him and you talked about the drafting
mm-hmm.
specifically about how he has, you know, a board that demonstrates that going back to 2003, they have had the worst possible draft positions. Early on, by the way, it seemed as if Doug Wilson only wanted to draft players from his old junior team, the Ottawa 67s.
Served them well on Logan Couture.
I did. Yes. And there was a plenty of Derek Jocelyn and mm-hmm. Jason Demers. And like every year it's like, okay, which 67 is Doug Wilson going to draft? But they have done well. Like given the position that they've been in for that long, Detroit was the same way. They've done well at the draft.
It's funny. Like I once said to him that Doug Wilson, that you know, people say that you're a really good salesman. And he didn't like the fact that I used the phrase salesman. He said that what I believe is we've got something here that we are very proud of, and I am happy to sell that. Mm-hmm. I am happy to tell people how good we feel about what we've done in San Jose. When you're trying to trade with Doug Wilson, you know what his nickname is? The Dentist.
Oh, you mentioned that last week. Yeah,
because,
yeah.
Like, when he's in the chair, when he's got you in the chair and he's working over you, he's the dentist. But I have heard that when you're talking to him about his team and he can talk to you about what they're doing, he is very convincing. People call him the closer. Yeah. And when I heard after, and we all heard this after, that he flew to Toronto with Peter DeBoer to meet with Erik Karlsson, then... You know, I'm not surprised Erik Karlsson would agree to go to San Jose.
Who's the odd man out there on the blue line with Karlsson?
Tim Heed now. He is. And I had Heed on my fantasy team last year, and he's a good power play guy. I'd be surprised if he doesn't end up somewhere. I think there's probably some teams saying that they hope San Jose puts him on waivers so they can get him free. Mm-hmm. But either he might keep him on the roster, or if you're higher up, I think if you've got a spot in your second unit of power play, even your first unit of power play or something, you need a shooter. He's not a bad guy to have there.
Speaking of defensemen, you surprised Ryan Merkley's still there?
I am a little bit surprised. I am a little bit surprised simply because, you know, we thought he would have been back in junior by now.
They're back with the Guelph Storm. They're giving this guy every single chance. Well, like, the skill set, he's, like, what did we say last year, the draft in Dallas? He's got top five skill.
Yeah.
Top five skill in the draft.
But I think also what they're trying to do is they want him around their guys. Like, they want him to see what a, like, what were all the knocks on him? He's not professional, right?
Selfish, bad
so
teammate,
he's going to be, he's going to be around a lot of guys who are different guys, but they find a common bond. So it's interesting that they're going to have Karlsson play with Vlasic. It's going to be really interesting in Burns with Ryan. I wouldn't be
hopefully now people appreciate how good Vlasic is. Because there's so much attention on that.
Nobody gets shafted more than that guy.
Everybody should appreciate how good. This could be fantastic for Vlasic.
Yeah. And you know, the best thing about Vlasic is, too, he's a great interview.
He is. You want to get him good on something?
What's that?
Dogs.
Yeah, he's always talking about dogs. He's always got the pictures. I think it's really interesting. Like, the great story about Plattner is that he had a staff meeting there once, and he said to all the staff, the three worst things you can own are a hotel, a golf course, and a hockey team. And I own all three of them. Like that's, but, and Wilson said it in the conversation I had with him. And that is that, you know, for a guy who's really busy and he's all over the world, when he is called upon, he does whatever. And he's a good owner. Like I think a lot of people would love to have mm-hmm. that kind of owner.
Speaking of owners, should we all start to get more used to the idea of celebrity owners? You know, we're approaching an era now in hockey. We've seen in other sports now where we know who all the general managers are and they become personalities. We've had that years ago with the coaches, certainly with the players, of course. But now are we getting to the era where we all know who the owner is because, to your point earlier, they invest a lot of money, they want to be hands-on, and we're going to know them and we're going to know their style. We'll get to Carolina and Tom Dundon here in a second. But should we just get used to that fact that there are going to be more owners that become one of the personalities on their team, and we all know them?
I think it's either one or the other. Like, I think there's some guys who really love it and some guys who really hate it.
There are some, like, you'll see me at Christmas and you'll see me at the end of the year, and other than that, you're not going to hear from me.
Like,
those
look,
days are gone.
You look at it, like, the guys Comcast who own the Flyers, like, Snyder was the Flyers, and you never see those guys. You know, Larry Tannenbaum is a lot less visible. You can find him around in Toronto, but he doesn't talk very much. I think it becomes one way or the other. And I think there's some guys who see a lot of the heat that Dundon took in Carolina, and they're like, I'm happy to have somebody else take that instead of me.
Do you get a sense of what the NHL prefers? Do you get a sense of what type of owner Gary Bettman prefers?
If you looked at how Stern battled with Cuban, I think Bettman likes his quieter owners. Like, how many owners in the NHL do you ever hear from? You never hear from Anschutz in L.A. No. You never hear from Sam Welly.
Too busy building rinks all over the world.
Yeah, you never hear from Sam Welly in Anaheim.
Yep. You know, you're from Calgary when they want a rink.
Well, but even like
you don't even hear from Edmonton because Daryl Cates in California.
But even Murray Edwards, like last year when all that stuff was going on, I had to run him down at the Board of Governors meeting, and he was nice, but he clearly didn't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. He prefers to be out of the spotlight. Jeremy Jacobs, I mean, how often do you see him?
Lockout Jeremy Jacobs.
And he does one press conference a year.
Yeah. You know, but Ed Snyder was front and center.
Ed Snyder was. Jim Dolan, you never see him. He's much more visible with the Knicks than he is with the Rangers.
Terry Pegula.
Rocky Wirtz. He was out doing a book signing recently, but and he'll do an availability once or twice a year, but generally he's not out there very much.
The Florida guys were out there, but now they've calmed down the act.
Yeah, Florida's quiet now. Carolina, even Dundon has been very quiet this preseason.
Aha!
Tom Gilardi in Dallas. He does some things periodically, but generally he's not out there. He prefers to leave it to his GM. St. Louis, you almost never see her from Stillman. Like, there's a lot of very quiet guys in the NHL.
You mentioned Tom Dundon, and this is one of my, you and I disagree on this, one of my pet causes is primary colors on the ice with the uniforms. And we saw yesterday Carolina and Nashville. Now, Carolina's done this twice. They did it in Tampa, right? So there's a red versus blue. Last night there was the hot dog game, the red versus yellow, the mustard and ketchup game. And like Dundon hasn't been shy about, and he's talked about this publicly, saying, look, white looks bad. I don't ever want to wear white. I want our team wearing white jerseys. I wonder if the NHL would ever let him do that in the regular season. It seems if they're okay with him obviously doing it in the preseason. I wonder if Carolina could be the test case for we're wearing red all the time or black.
You know, Jeff, I got to tell you, as I get older, I'm ready for all this stuff.
Yeah,
I believe the NHL is going to have to move. I really believe this.
Hoping to get a fight out of you.
No, you know, Jeff, I am going this way now.
Just try it and let's see.
It goes back to a lot of the stuff I talked about with Katie Crawford in the 31 Thoughts blog this week. And if you didn't read it, Katie Crawford is Mark Crawford's daughter. I saw Mark Crawford last year in the summer at the coaches conference. It was phenomenal. I learned a lot there. So Mark gets up to speak for about 10, 15 minutes, and he turns it over to his son, Dylan, who's the video coach at AHL Belleville. And then Dylan turns it over to Katie, his daughter. She just finished 5 years of playing volleyball at UBC, and she's there taking her master's. And she starts talking about reaching millennials. And after it was over, like, all these coaches made a beeline for her. It didn't matter the coach, boys, girls, men, women, whatever. Like, they're like, I can't reach these kids. Like, how do I do it? And I spoke to her on Sunday. You know, we talked about some more stuff. And she just said, like, hockey has good values, but the way you teach those values has to change. Because the horse is out of the barn, and these kids are not going to be the same as the kids above them, and you can't change it. And I think what people want now, this younger generation, they want to feel that they belong to something, but they want to feel that they can contribute to what they belong to. She talked to me about how you have more friends online, but those friendships are less meaningful than the ones we had when we were growing up. And I found it all really interesting. And since I wrote that, I've had like three people asking to talk to her.
Hmm.
Like, can I speak to this person?
The people in the NHL.
One in the NHL,
right,
and two like outside it, but like also dealing with millennials.
Does that wink at a bigger issue, which is how the NHL has a hard time with young people?
I think it's just that the NHL is a league of conformists. And I do think the NHL teaches good values, like how to be a good teammate, how to work in a system, how to work in a group. But her point is that you can't just tell people that this is how you're going to fit in the group and this way goes.
Yeah.
You're going to have to say to them, we want to be in a group. I want to mold you there. Now, how do you think you need to be molded to get there, kind of thing? But I think that goes to that kind of stuff you're talking about. I'm a big believer that the league is going to have to become less stiff. And one of the things is, don't hesitate to try stuff like that. Like, we joked at the top of the podcast, what's the biggest story in the NHL this week? It's Grizz. It's Grizzy. Gritty. Whatever his stupid name is. It's Gritty. because it's so weird. Like, you look at that, it's like, that's not the NHL I know. And you
it's
know,
awesome.
And it's
okay.
It's
There's
different.
Room for all of it.
It's right. Like, Jeff, we've known each other for a long time. Like, you knew me when I was 23 years old. And I was just starting out in the business. Like, I was, like, all serious all the time. Bob Mackowitz, when he was the producer.
I was the exact opposite.
Right.
I was the exact opposite.
And Bob Mackowitz, not your buddy, but his dad, he once told me, Elliot, I listen to you on The Fan here, and all you do is bring the heat. Like, you got to do some other stuff. You got to mix in, like, a curveball or something once in a while. And as I've gotten older, I really understand now more than ever, if everybody was like me, it would be so boring. So you need all different kinds. And that's why I think that the league is going to have to embrace, like, the league that to me that's trending the best
NBA.
Is the NBA. And that's because they embrace personality and they embrace difference. I think that there's a whole bunch of people in the NHL who are willing to prove they can be different and fun, but in a way that doesn't make them bad for the game. I just think the game has to let that happen.
Is that why this game needs either on the ice or off the ice, in front of a camera, Kevin Bieksa in it?
Like, if he wants to do TV, he's going to be
tomorrow.
He's going to be right in there. Like, Scott Hartnell's working at the NHL Network now a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, he's another guy who I think would be really good. But yeah, Bieksa, when I spoke to him the other day, I said, are you still keeping in shape? And he goes, yes, I'm still in better shape than 95% of the players and 100% of the media. And he couldn't even get it out with a straight face. Like, he was laughing as he said it.
But you know, one of the good examples of all this is you're talking about, and these are guys that are out of the NHL now,
mm-hmm.
but personality-based. Like, you look at the success of Spit and Chicklets.
Yeah.
You look at the success of that podcast. For, I don't know, how many years have we been thinking about this idea that one day two hockey players are going to get together to do something and just talk like hockey. We've all heard them before. Just talk like they talk at the gym, at the saloon, at the restaurant, wherever, and it's going to be a hit. Chiklis taps into that.
Yeah. Like, I listen to some of the stuff on there, and I'm like, there's no way I could say it. But I laugh. Like, there was one story they were telling, I almost drove off the road. Like, I couldn't believe
that's
they,
great.
They
that's,
were doing
it's a
this.
Great pod. It is,
but,
odd,
is,
but you know what?
It is,
you and I can't do that pod.
No. You
not
know,
even close.
We can't. And first of all, I don't think we'd have the buy-in from the players to tell those stories. Like, you know, Mike Rinell does a good job of, like, lobbing to Bissonnette and to Whitney. And those guys were very popular teammates. And you can see that guys like them. And also, like, there's no way that Rogers is letting us do that. Like, there is just no way. But it's good. And that's why I understand, like, there's room for everything. And I think that in the NHL, there is room for everything.
Room for everything. Is there room for John McFarland?
Credit goes to you. And I actually was annoyed when I saw you today that I forgot to put your name in the story. Because,
you'll hear from my attorney.
Yeah, because you were the person who told me about this. And I do like to give credit to people who tell me about things. And that is that you told me about, you know, John McFarland would be a really good story. And he'd already been sent to Bakersfield when I contacted him. But I sent a note to the Oilers. They said, here's Bakersfield. And Ryan in Bakersfield, he had it done by that night. And John was really good. I like seeing stories like that. You know John McFarland really well.
Yeah, full transparency. We work out of the same gym. I see John
all the time. He mentioned that you're in
good
shape, eh? He said, Jeff's in really good shape.
A couple extra bucks in your envelope this week. John, thanks, buddy. I've known John for a number of years, got to know him really well at the gym. And I'm glad you put that in the piece, this quote about sort of growing up, because the first John McFarland that I met at the gym when I first moved to Stouffville is not the guy right now.
Yep.
Different. He was playing in the Florida Panthers organization, playing in the American Hockey League, really different guy. And, you know, if you don't know the story, he's a first overall draft pick in the OHL playing with the junior Canadians, playing on a stacked team. Like, they were, like, John McFarland was, you know, the best player on the team. But, I mean, Tyler Toffoli was on that team. Devontae Smith-Pelly was on that JRC team. Really good team. Second round draft pick of the Florida Panthers, and played a couple of games with the Florida Panthers when Gerard Gallant was coaching. But then...
Three games.
Yeah, that was it. Mm-hmm. And then went and played in Europe, had the shoulder issues, and has come back and kind of said, like, this is my shot at it. And no, by the way, I am not the friend at the gym that Elliot references.
No, you're
in
not.
The piece.
I actually asked if you were the guy, and he said no.
I'm not the friend at the gym in question. But you know what? I had this conversation with John right before he went to Oilers camp. actually, I saw a documentary that has some thoughts behind it that speak to this. I've always felt that hard work doesn't guarantee you results. You can work as hard as you want, but if you think that your hard work isn't going to get you results, I think you set yourself up for failure.
Mm-hmm.
I've always believed in my life that hard work sets you up for an answer.
Mm-hmm.
You get an answer to a question that very few people ever get, and that is, how good am I?
Mm-hmm.
There's a documentary on Driveline about Casey Weathers. Casey Weathers was a baseball player, pitcher, real good, drafted by Colorado, never really worked out. But there's a piece up on Driveline, I'll link it up on my Twitter, where he talks about everything that he's gone through and all the rehab and how he wanted the answer to that question. And that's what hard work gives you.
But I couldn't walk away like that. Because in the back of your mind, you know. You know if your career is just one elaborate lie that you tell your family and friends to save yourself from the admission of failure. If I could just get back healthy and prepare the way I wanted to, and it just turns out that I stink and I can't get anyone out, then I stink and I shouldn't be playing. At least that's the truth. Motivation is a myth. There's a mental game 101 idea that says excellence is mundane. It means the people who are the best at stuff are the ones who do the repetitive tasks day after day after day. They don't wake up with a burning desire to be better than they were the day before, or wake up every day like it's Christmas morning because they get to go do what they love. I've worked. I've rehabbed. I did as much as I could do that was in my control, and I took away every excuse that I could give myself. Hard work doesn't guarantee you results. It guarantees you honesty.
Hard work doesn't guarantee you results. Hard work will get you an honest answer to the question, how good am I? I think we're all sort of looking for that, and you're only going to get an honest answer if you're all in, if you're the all-in guy. I get up every day, and you work hard. I work hard. Like, I get up, and I think about work, and I work a lot because I want an honest answer one day. When my career is wrapped up, I want to be able to say, okay, how good was I? That's why I'm going to work hard every single day, because if I don't, then I'm not going to get an honest answer, because I'm not asking an honest question. I'm not asking for anything to honestly come back. And I had this conversation with John when he left. I'm like, you know what? I've seen you work so hard to get back. What you're going to get is an answer to the question, how good am I? And very few people get that. People are like, oh, you know what? I kind of mailed it in a little bit, half-assed it a little bit. You're not going to get an honest answer to the question, how good am I? And I think what's good for John, no matter what happens with John McFarland now or next year or 5 years from now, at least he's going to get an answer.
Yes, I agree
very
with
few
that.
Guys
very
get
well
that.
Said.
Very few guys get that answer. So in this capacity, I don't cheer for teams, but I cheer for people.
Yep.
And John is one of those people that I cheer for. His old team, the Florida Panthers. Captaincy change.
Mm-hmm.
From McKenzie to Barkov.
Mm-hmm.
How was that received? You write about it in 31 Thoughts.
I think they understood. I think those players understood that it was time. You know, it was interesting at the league and players' media availability in Chicago. You know, Vinny Trocheck, he speaks like Barkov, like he walks on water. Like, you can tell that Trocheck is a big acolyte of Barkov.
See, when you talk about players with personality and not being shy, I think of the Vinny Trocheck during the Tom Rowe era.
Yeah.
And I think of, you know, even Vinny Trocheck, he was actually a former teammate of John McFarland back in junior. Like, he's always been that not shy to speak his mind guy.
Well, that's what even the Panthers say when they drafted him. Like, there's a lot of confidence there. So that was a lot. And I really like that kid, too. I think he's a great talker.
Me, too.
Good player. You know, and I thought that Luongo said it really well. You know, it was brought to my attention that it happened with him. I completely forgot that he was there and that it happened. And he said that when McKenzie told him about it, you know, he just said, you have to understand, like, where we're going here. And the one thing is that McKenzie got to wear it. I think that's the kind of point that Luongo was making when he joked that
fourth-line plug.
Even a fourth-line plug got to be captain.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is, Derek McKenzie was an older guy. He's fought and scrapped for everything he's gotten in this league. If I was in his shoes, I wouldn't be upset that it got taken away from me, because I'd look at who's getting it and I'd be like, I get it. But I would look at it as, I got to wear it. And especially at the point in his career where he got to wear it. I don't think it's easy, Jeff. I don't think it's ever easy. But I think if I was in his shoes, I would look at it in the best possible way.
My first thought when I saw them taking the C from McKenzie and giving it to Barkov was, this is going to serve McKenzie well in his next career, because I firmly believe that he's one of those guys that's going to be a coach.
Probably.
And this is an experience he's going to be able to draw on should this ever happen to his team.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to be one of those great moments where he's going to be able to look back and say, well, you know what? I was a fourth-line guy with the Florida Panthers wearing the C, and I had it taken off me and given to Alexander Barkov, and I had to be a good teammate about it.
And he participated in the...
All of it.
The I don't know what you call it, ceremony, but he participated in it. I got a lot of respect for that.
Me too. I got all the time in the world for guys like McKenzie. And I got all the time in the world for guys like Alexander Barkov as well. Not the most vocal.
Well, they said that he said he might even be less vocal than Henrik Sedin. Like, that's a low bar.
I remember him at the draft in New Jersey, barely getting a couple of words out. I guess he spoke Russian mainly at home growing up.
Yeah.
And then learned English.
But you know what I'll tell you? When they came to Toronto for a game last year, and I talked to him for a couple seconds. And
Russian and Finnish.
And I asked him a little bit about Matthews, and he told me about a play that Matthews made in a 1-0 game against them.
Yeah.
And I went back and found it so we could show it in the pregame show, and it was exactly as Barkov remembered it.
Right, eh?
He's one of those high IQ guys.
He works on shootout moves every practice, I'm told.
Yeah.
He gets goaltenders to bite on the fakes for fakes. Like, that's how high-end he's thinking now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, the Kent Nielsen, Peter Forsberg move? If you telegraph it a certain way, the goalie will bite on it. He'll do that now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's taking it next level. Not like, oh, here comes the UC Jokinen or the Peter Forsberg, whatever you want to call it. Now he's telegraphing that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Barkov is telegraphing it, getting the goalie to bite on that fake, and then doing something else.
Right.
This guy's insane. Gonna take a pause. When we come back, you will hear from Tyler Seguin of the Dallas Stars. You will also hear from Dallas Green. The GMC Sierra Denali sets a higher standard in a full-size pickup for purposeful technology and performance. Features like Apple CarPlay keeps you connected to what matters most, and an available 420 horsepower 6.2-liter engine gives you the power to take on any challenge. Lead the way like a pro with the GMC Sierra Denali. GMC, we are professional grade. Elliot Friedman making news not too long ago. Tyler Seguin of the Dallas Stars. It is an 8-year contract. It is $78 million. And just when you think that's a whopper, the way it was announced by the Dallas Stars on Twitter may have been the trump card in all of it. Tyler Seguin joins the 31 Thoughts podcast now. Tyler, first of all, congrats on the deal, as belated as it may be. But I do want to start by asking you about the Mario Brothers, the video game announcement on Dallas Stars Twitter. Did you know they were going to do that?
I knew about 30 seconds after they put it out. So it wasn't a question of whether they're doing it or not. They said they had it for probably, you know, 3 or 4 months, really since the draft. And then just in case I signed, they had it ready to go. And once I saw it, I had a little bit of mixed feelings. I was like, that's pretty cool. I don't know how people are going to take it. And I think people are more excited about the actual type of announcement than me actually signing. So, you know, it was good work.
So it was, they must have been just going back and forth day by day. Okay, what is the decimal point going to be here? Like, the basis of it was all set. They're just waiting to see where they put the decimal.
Yeah, they said they had it buried, you know, ready to go and since the draft. And then once it all happened, it was out there. So people liked it, and I thought it was funny. So it was good.
You know, Tyler, I was interested in the approach about how this all changed. There was a time that Jim Neal was saying, look, like, if it's not done by opening night, nobody should panic. And then at the BioSteel camp last week of August, you used the word disappointed 4 times, and everything seemed to accelerate from there. Can you take us through what kind of happened?
Yeah, I mean, that was the first time I talked to really any media in a few months. You know, originally, at our exit meetings, we talked about hopefully having it done by the draft, and this is my first negotiation, so I didn't really know what to expect. And, you know, when I talked to media at Ballester Camp, I really didn't have any, strategy or, you know, go into the media and say certain things. I was really just being honest.
No, nothing's really going on. Pretty much haven't been talking much this summer. It's been It's been a little disappointing. You know, I thought I'd have, some exciting news to talk about at Valsa Camp, especially this late in the summer. But it honestly hasn't really been much of a thought. You know, I wasn't really expecting this. So, you know, like I said, I was, you know, I'm disappointed it hasn't happened. Or, you know, it didn't. But, yeah, I mean, there hasn't been negotiations. It's just been, you know, training this summer, getting ready for this year. Since day one, I've still had this last year here in Dallas. And, you know, Dallas is home. You know, I'm looking forward to having a good year. And, you know, I definitely want to win.
And at the end of the day, it kind of turned out to be a strategic move, I guess, because things did get moving after that. But, you know, it was honestly just me being honest. You know, I didn't want to negotiate in the media, but I was disappointed at the time. You know, I thought things would be moving quicker, and they weren't. And, you know, I was learning part of the business. So it was definitely a great learning experience, but I'm also, you know, very happy it's all said and done.
Did you ever think it wasn't going to get done?
Yeah, there was probably a few days before it got done. I thought it wasn't going to happen. Honestly, you know, I thought, you know, we just weren't there. And then, you know, things just escalated kind of 24 hours before I actually signed. And then the next morning, it was there, drawn up and ready to go. And I was ecstatic. You know, I've always wanted to be a Dallas Star for my career, you know, the rest of my career, really, since I touched down from the trade from Boston. And, you know, this is home, so I was really happy it was all done.
Tyler, you mentioned this with your first negotiation. Now that you have, you know, hindsight and, you know, you have that wisdom, yeah, having gone through it. If you had to do it again, would you have done anything differently?
No, I don't think so. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, my dream was still to stay in Dallas. I mean, that was my goal. You know, I really wanted to stay here. I was going to accept the fact that, you know, this is a business. I learned the hard way when I got traded from Boston. And if we didn't have signing, you know, I understood the reasoning behind it. And, you know, I was ready to play out my contract here. But first and foremost, I wanted to be a Dallas Star. You know, and this has been home. You know, I love the room, the guys. I love the organization, the front office and everybody. And it was a place where I honestly wanted to be. So, like I said, I'm happy it's all said and done. And, you know, now we can just focus on getting back in playoffs.
You know, Tyler Seguin Day was almost Tyler Seguin, Eric Karlsson Day in Dallas. A lot of people may have been expecting two announcements coming from the Stars. What was that day like? And how closely did you follow the Eric Karlsson story?
You know, you got to be careful, right? There's rumors every day, whether it's, you know, myself signing or whether it's, you know, even the Dallas Stars getting Tavares or Karlsson. And I've learned that over the years that, you know, you're happy that guys are interested, but you also understand that it might not happen. So you try not to get too high or low. But obviously, I think we were in the race here for Karlsson. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's all great that these top players want to come to, you know, the Dallas Stars organization because it is such a good market. And, you know, it's a lot better than people might talk about. So at the end of the day, we're happy that, you know, he talks about maybe coming here. I followed it. You know, I was hoping he did. But, you know, I'm sure he's happy there in San Jose.
Tyler, I understand that you have a problem that I wish I had. And that is you cannot put on weight no matter what people try.
This is true.
Like, somebody told me, I think actually it was Brett Valiquette, who works at your agency. He told me that you had put on like 15 pounds this year. And I looked at you at the NHL and the Players Media Day, and nobody could tell. So tell me about this. Like, how hard is it for you to gain weight?
It's not so much gaining weight. Well, I guess it is a little bit of gaining weight, but it's really keeping on weight. You know, I have, I guess you can call it a problem, but I have, you know, a struggle with keeping my weight up throughout the season. You know, and most years I'll lose, 10 to 13 pounds, depending on the year. I mean, when we went deep into playoffs, you know, especially in Boston, my first and third year, I was losing like 15 to 17 pounds. So it really changes my approach to the off season. You know, I usually put on, like this summer, I put on 15 pounds. Last year was the first year where I really had a chef at my house, and I was focusing more on, you know, what I was eating just to keep that weight up. You know, the boys joke about my body fat a lot just because it is so low and it gets low. And this is the first year where I got it over 4%. So I'm happy about that. And, you know, hopefully I can keep it up.
Do you change your stick flex at all then throughout the year to compensate for losing weight and strength? I remember talking to Daniel Briere once and he said, you know, I start with like a 110. I'm down to 85 by the time the playoffs are done.
Yeah, it changes sometimes. You know, last year it changed, but it depends too. Like on the power play, it'll change a lot as well. And throughout the year, you know, I do probably change a stick once or twice, whether it's the kick point or the flex, just depending on how my body is reacting. But last year, I really did learn a lot, you know, with having a chef, with focusing more on certain things the night before games to keep that weight up, and whether it's protein shakes and stuff. And so So that did change, and I think it helped my year last year, and, you know, it was a good learning process, and, you know, I want to keep doing it this year as well.
You mentioned the power play. Last year, Ken Hitchcock is the head coach. Was it just me, or was I seeing Tyler Seguin in different positions on the power play that I've never seen him for? I remember watching Dallas's power play and saying, I'm not used to seeing Seguin there. All of us, like, where did all that come from? How was that for you?
That really was all Hitch, and that was something he talked to me since day one about, that he wanted me in the slot in the power play in different areas. I was on my strong side, and I ended up scoring more goals because of it. But to be honest, I mean, at first I was not happy about it. You know, I was grumpy in practice having to go in the slot. And then all of a sudden, you know, my first game against Vegas at home, I scored on a tip-in from the slot. And I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe, you know, I can do this and go to different areas. So I really did enjoy how Hitch brought that on my game. You know, he really did a lot for me. I know everyone has their own opinions, but he was great for me, just the opportunities he gave me, whether it's penalty kill or new positions on the power play. And it helped develop my game more last year, and, you know, makes me more comfortable going in this season to be out there, whether it's a 5-on-3 kill where you don't usually see me, or in the slot on a power play.
So what does Jim Montgomery have you doing?
He's got everything from last year. You know, I've only played in one preseason game so far, but, you know, I was in the spot I was last year. It wasn't so, you know, typical of my past being just on the one-timer, like a Stamkos on a power play. You know, I was killing on a 5-on-3. So, you know, the opportunities are still there. I obviously got to, you know, earn them again this year and keep improving.
How do you feel about the team this year? This is, you know, expectations high for the Dallas Stars, and rightfully so. Playing a really tough division. Where are you at right now with your squad?
We're in a good spot right now. Preseason's been good. Training camp's been great. You know, our speed has, you know, gotten even quicker. You know, I think last year our speed wasn't as high as it was because we were playing so defensive. But, you know, going in this year, I think our tempo's going to be quicker. But we also learned a lot last year about how to defend a little bit better. So I think we can take Hitch's system and then bring it in with Jim Montgomery's. You know, I think the ceiling's high for us. We want those expectations. So, you know, looking forward to a good year.
There was that one year under under Lindy Ruff where it was just fly zone Dallas Stars, and it was fun. It was 80s hockey all over again. What was, I mean, just, I'm thinking of from a player's point of view, this must just be a lot of fun to play.
Honestly, it was a lot of fun, but it was, again, it was another learning process for our team, just because, you know, we were going out trying to win games 6-5, 5-4, 7-6. You know, that's how we played and how we tried to win, and we had to learn the hard way that you just can't win like that anymore. You know, you got to win the games 2-1 or 1-0. And that's something we learned more with Hitch, and now we got to find the sweet spot between it. And I think, like you said, our division's one of the hardest divisions, I think, in all sports. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, you make playoffs, you know, you're even more prepared because you're playing playoff hockey, you know, by, you know, November, December.
Can Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin be the highest scoring teammates in the NHL this year?
I don't know if that's our goal. I think our goal is to be the most hardest to play against. You know, what we do still talk about, you know, when we go to play games again in Chicago or Pittsburgh, you know, against, you know, other duos, we want to outplay them. You know, that's our job. We got to beat that first line. But nowadays, we got Alex Radulov, and, you know, he's a guy that, you know, we like to call ourselves more the triplets than a duo anymore, because, you know, his work ethic is just, it's not even talked about enough, you know, how hard he competes, how hard he practices, and, you know, if we're having an off night, he gets us going. So a lot of good things last year, and we want to keep improving, like I said.
How often would you talk to John Klingberg? Klingberg, to me, is one of the more interesting defensemen, and, you know, probably doesn't get the headlines that he deserves. I remember when he came in, you know, playing in Sweden, he had that reputation. He was like the one guy that would do this, who wouldn't, you know, line up for the big slap shot from the point on the power play. He would just sort of sift in shots, but generally they were high. He was one of those defensemen that wasn't shy about sending in shots high, much to teammates' chagrin. Ever a conversation there with John Klingberg about it?
Yeah, they're still high, but they're not face level anymore, you know, which is something he's learned, which has been great. But, no, like you said, I mean, we were almost a little angry at some points, you know, with the media last year because he wasn't talked about so much with the Norris stuff and them talking about all these other defensive players out there. But John Klingberg, I mean, if he's sitting in Montreal right now, you know, he's the most talked about defenseman in the NHL. He's very smart with the puck. You know, he's even gotten a lot better defensively, and I think this year you might see him play even more minutes.
You know what? I'll tell you a story about that. Not so much about Klingberg, but I did have a player on your team last year reach out and say, I don't care who you vote for what, but Radek Faksa should get Selke consideration. And he was adamant. That he said, I know you guys are already overlooking Klingberg, but Faksa is another guy getting even more overlooked.
I think if you sit here and you call a guy on every team and you ask about our squad and they say, who don't you want to play against, they're going to probably say Rad Faxa. Yeah, you know, our line with Rajal and Ben, you got to be defensive because we're going to, you know, make you earn yourself getting out of the D zone. But Faxa is just a guy that's hard to play against. You miss scrimmages and practices. You know, I'll line up against him a lot. You know, he's a great shutdown player. He reminds me a lot of a guy like Patrice Bergeron, who I played with before. Obviously, you know, Bergeron's made quite the name for himself, but I think Fox is a guy that can get to that level, or at least close to it, and I think he's going to be a heck of a player for a long time.
In the Western Conference, as you well know, it's a murderer's row of centers, whether it's Connor McDavid, whether it's Ryan Getzlaff, whether it's Anze Kopitar, whether it's Mark Scheifele, whether it's yourself. It's tough playing down the middle in the Western Conference. Who gives you the greatest fits when you match up?
It's tough to say. I mean, every night's a new challenge. You know, you kind of, you know, hit the ball on the head there with the guys like Kopitar. You know, I really do focus on things like face-offs and know who I'm up against the upcoming night. But, you know, a team like Winnipeg is definitely, you know, a team that went on the rise last year, a team that I was always, you know, our team was, and I was always personally successful against. But how much Scheifele's developed and guys like Blake Wheeler and how they are down the middle, they're not an easy team to play against. You know, it was just Brian Little, really, a couple of years ago, who was a good player, but now they got all that depth. I mean, they're a team that you definitely know when they're in town, and, you know, you got to bring your competitive side that night.
Final one for me, Tyler, is as we prepared for this interview today, I got an email saying that you had signed a new off-ice, I don't know if endorsement's the right word, but you've joined a company to do some stuff off the ice. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a lot of guys from IMG from Los Angeles and Miami, and we're going to be doing a lot of good things with my foundation. We're going to continue to grow that. I'm going to get more on the fashion side. There's going to be some knapsacks and obviously my clothing and hat line and just some fun stuff off the ice. Any opportunity to interact with fans, I've always enjoyed, whether it's social media or foundation events, and there's going to be a lot of good things coming. I can't wait for it to grow. I don't think we're going to get to PK Subban level, but I'd like to be a second star behind them, so we'll see.
Do you have a logo yet, Tyler?
I do. We do have a logo, yeah. There's a TS logo. I love it because you wouldn't fully know it's TS unless I tell you or unless you know the brand. So I think it's going to be successful, and, you know, hopefully it all works out.
That's awesome. Best of luck with that, and best of luck with the Stars this year. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks, Tyler.
All right, thanks for having me, guys.
Hockey season is back with Tim Hortons NHL trading cards. Just $1 with the purchase of any beverage. Plus, play online at collecttowin.ca for a chance to meet Sidney Crosby. Plus taxes at participating Tim Hortons restaurants for a limited time.
Now my dreams are nothing like they were meant to be, and I'm breaking down. I think I'm breaking down. I'm afraid to sleep because of what haunts me. Tell the chance, living with the uncertainty.
Welcome back to 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Jeff Merrick alongside Elliot Friedman. What you are hearing is just a beautiful song, Sleeping Sickness. This is performed by Dallas Green, City and Color, in Halifax, part of a new live album he has coming out October 5th.
Someone come and save my life. Maybe I'll sleep.
Jeff Merrick, Elliot Friedman, 31 Thoughts Podcast. Elliot, this is what we describe as a real treat. All morning long, I have had, you know, when like a worm burns into your brain with a song and you can't get it out of your head? I've had Love Gone Wrong in my head all day long. Collaboration between Pink and Dallas Green. Singer, songwriter, sports fan, who, as we've just recently found out, has been at some pretty key sporting events over the past few years.
Hello, thank you for having me. And yes.
How would you have introduced yourself? I'm thinking to myself, how am I going to introduce Dallas Green on a hockey podcast?
I don't know. I mean, I was going to ask, I was just wondering to see how you guys would do. I think you did good.
Did I do okay?
I think so.
Pass the audition?
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple things about Dallas that I've learned, and I remember hearing the story years ago. The first World Series I remember watching was 1977, Dodgers versus Yankees. But one of the best World Series early in my life was 1980, which was Philadelphia versus the Kansas City Royals. And I was cheering for the Royals because I loved George Brett, but Philadelphia beat them. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know this until recently, but you were named after the Phillies manager, Dallas Green.
Correct.
To which I say, thank goodness that your dad's favorite player wasn't Tug McGraw.
I know. Yeah, it's always been an interesting story for me to tell. Obviously, I mean, I thank my father for
giving you a cool name.
For giving me a cool name, but it is only because the Phillies won and because he bet money on the Phillies to win.
Ah.
That's what it was.
Okay, okay.
And so it's more that he's a gambler than a, I mean, he is a sports fan as well. But yeah, that's, my mom wanted to name me Graham Todd, hyphenated, Graham Todd Green. And my dad said no. And then the Phillies won and I got Dallas, which I feel like.
With all due respect.
Thanks, Mom.
You got it.
Yeah.
Fathers lose that argument. So you're lucky your dad's a forceful person.
I know. I'm assuming it had something to do with the money as well. So,
so what was it for you growing up then? Growing up in St. Catharines?
Yeah.
Sports, music, both?
One. It was both.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was. My mom and dad were both good at just trying to have me and my sister, like, just try tons of stuff.
Yeah.
Just
mm-hmm.
kind of see what stuck.
Yeah.
So that included, you know, baseball and basketball early, and also signed me up for guitar lessons when I was 8. Not because I really showed an interest in it, just to see.
Yeah.
You know, that I think the idea of trying to offer their kids a bunch of opportunities that maybe they didn't have when they were younger.
Mm.
So I was always trying to be on the, you know, my dad coached me in Little League, but also signed me up for guitar lessons. And early on into high school, I realized that as much as I loved playing sports, I seem to excel a little bit more at the music side of things. So I took to that.
You know, our son now, he's about to turn 7, and he's not big into sports, but he loves music. As a matter of fact, his birthday is coming up. We're looking at purchasing a drum set for him.
Okay, good.
Because he likes, like, we took him into a drum store, and he could have sat there all day.
Drum is awesome. The most important part of the band, just so you know.
Okay, that's good. Now I like that.
What do you call the people musicians hang out with? Drummers. Continue.
That's very good, Jeff. I like
no
that.
Problem.
So, like, what advice would you give for a young kid? And I think this goes for athletes, too. Like, sometimes people don't always encourage it.
Right.
What was the best advice maybe your parents gave you, and what was the best advice you would give to someone trying to cultivate a young, talented person?
Well, the drumming is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, most good singers would tell you that it's not about them. It's about the person who's holding the backbeat down.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good start. But I would say for the musical side of it, just make sure that he listens to everything. Don't get pigeonholed in, like, you know, if you're like a metalhead and you just want to listen to metal. Well, you're missing out on so many other different good songs and good types of music. But also, the more styles of music you learn and are fluent in, the more ability you have to play with different types of people. You know what I mean? Especially as a drummer. And then as far as, like, for me, the I always had supportive parents in the sense that not only did they get me into music, but they allowed me to give it a shot. And I think that was something that was very important to me when I was younger. And I had a few teachers in high school that were very instrumental. And just when all of my friends were filling out their university applications and getting ready to go do this and that, and I was the one who really had no interest other than music, they sort of gave me that, you know, well, a bunch of teachers were saying, you need to get a backup plan, which maybe in hindsight I should have had one.
Mm.
But just the ability, the confidence to say, give it a shot, you know, because if you don't give it a chance, then you'll never know.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of something I always had. I always had good people beside me, whether it was my good friends or my family or good teachers that just said, you know.
Very good.
There's a great quote by the late philosopher Alan Watts, who passed in 73, who said, the greatest risk of all is not doing what you want to do, based on the bet that you can buy yourself the freedom to do it later.
Correct.
Which is why what you're saying is, well, I don't want to back up. This is what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm not going to gamble and do something else so I can do this later. I'm going to do this now.
Yeah, at least I'm at least going to try because, you know, I think to myself now, this was the thing that I was interested the most in. And, you know, I could have went to university for 4 years and majored in something or did music on the side and tried to do that. But I was just sort of interested in putting my whole self into it. And now, again, that's not necessarily going to work. Like my story, I'm thankful that it did work, you know. But I do feel like part of it was having the confidence from people around me saying, yeah, you know, keep going.
Same as athletes.
Correct.
Same as athletes.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, there's a saying in sports, excellence is mundane. That we see the highlights, that we see the home runs, we see the big goals. But what we don't see is those amazing athletes doing the same thing over and over and over and over. It is boring. It is rigorous. It is mentally taxing. It is not exciting.
Yes.
We see the benefit of it. We see what happens afterwards as fans, but we don't see that part. Is there an equivalent for musicians?
Yeah, absolutely. Touring is just that. I mean, it's one of those things where you, as an outsider, mostly you see the glamorous side of like being in a popular rock band or something.
Yeah.
But what you don't see is the monotony of it. You don't see it being just like anything else in life. There are good days and bad days. I've had shows where I've just been, and this could be part of my personality too, but you know, I've been on stage in front of 10,000 people at a festival and not really enjoyed it because I just wasn't having a good day, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've also had shows where I played in front of 20 people in Boise, Idaho, and I had the best night of my life. So there's that mental side of it that comes into play too. It, like you can set yourself up to have the best game or the best show, but sometimes real life creeps into it and it just gets you. But it's the ability to understand that if you're lucky enough, you get to wake up and you get to try it again. And I think that's the thing with the routine of athletes. And, you know, I don't want to go to the gym today, but I'm going to because I get to skate tonight and I might have the greatest game of my life tonight.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is obviously with sport is that there's, you know, an end game in a way. There's usually a winner and a loser and there's a competition aspect to it. But it is a similar, there's a kinship. And I know there's always people talk about how people in bands want to be athletes. And then there's always like the athletes that want to be in bands.
100% true.
And I've been lucky enough to meet a lot of people like that now and on the other side of the coin. And it is a similar thing because you just live this similar lifestyle in a way.
It was a Sports Illustrated cover probably about 30 years ago, I would say. I think I was around the time I was in university. And if I remember correctly, they had Ice Cube in a Shaquille O'Neal Lakers jersey. And in the cover, the article was why athletes want to be musicians and why musicians want to be athletes. It's a great story.
Yeah.
And I really do remember that very well. Okay, so I want to talk about some of your hockey love, your sports love. You were saying that off mic that you just sold your place in Nashville, but you lived there for 4 years and you really saw the rise to the top of the Predators.
Yeah, it was really crazy to see. You know what was interesting to see was when the Leafs made the playoffs for the first time after, what was it?
When they made the playoffs, 2011?
2012?
2013, right after the lockout.
Short season.
I played.
What happened in that playoff series? I don't remember.
Something about Boston. Lord. I can't remember. It was foggy.
I have a funny story about that, the game, but it involves being on the radio. But I played they did a big concert at Maple Leaf Square because it was, the first game was in Boston.
Yes.
And I played down there and the whole, and I'm a huge basketball fan too, right? So that was sort of like the beginning of the Jurassic Park and and everybody getting outside and watching the games. So I understood that, seeing that happen. But watching that happen in downtown Nashville, where it was like, you know, Broadway is like the country music. That's like, you know, the strip where they call it Nash Vegas now. But like going down there a couple of times during the playoffs and seeing the roads blocked off, not because there was a country music concert, but because there was Jumbotron set up for all of the people in Nashville to come out and watch the game outside of the arena. I was like, where am I? You know? And then like I told you guys, I went to game six where they beat Anaheim to go to the cup. And I'd been watching the playoffs and seeing the rowdiness. And I was like, I got to go, you know, if we're here, we have to go see a game. We have to try and get tickets. And I couldn't believe, and I'd been to games years before. I couldn't believe the atmosphere. And part of me as the Canadian, you know, I was being skeptical of it. Like everybody was saying, you got to come see a game here. And it was insane. And it wasn't just they weren't just excited because it was something. They were excited about their hockey team.
I look at that, and absolutely, then I look at Vegas, for example, and I always say to myself, and I think this is true of just about anything, whether it's sports, whether it's media, whether it's music, if you're honest about who you are as a person or as a sports team, you'll be a magnet, mm-hmm, and people will be attracted to that. I think people can sniff out BS, and if they think that you're faking the funk and you're not really like that, I think that's repellent.
Yeah.
I think Nashville's honest about who they are,
yeah,
and what that market is. We saw with Vegas last year. They are honest about,
yeah,
who they are and what they are, and
don't
people
run away
love
from
it.
Your identity.
And again, trying to draw these straight lines between sports and music, but I think this was true. That's got to be true of music as well. Like, you know when you're being legit.
Well, yeah, and to draw the line with Nashville, like, they know they are Music City. And yes, they maybe played up the idea of that, having like a different country singer come out and sing
the
national anthem. But what's wrong with that? Your town.
Yeah.
That's part of your identity, is you playing in Nashville. That's part of it. That's the city.
What was your radio story about Game 7 in 2013?
Okay, so there's a town, Boulder, Colorado.
Yeah.
There's a great independent radio station there. It's called E-Town. And they have they bought an old church and they renovated it, and they do these, Nick and Helen Forster, they run this show, and they have people come in and you play a couple of songs, you have a live interview, they record it professionally, and then they film it and they put it out. And I'd flown from Toronto to play festival and then do that. And as I was about to go on,
mm-hmm,
it was the third period and I was streaming it on a computer, and I went up and started to do my interview, and Nick, the guy, was like, is everything okay? And I was like,
dude,
Leafs are about to make it to the second round. And he was like, what? And I was like, the Leafs are about to make it to the second round of the playoffs. It's like pretty crazy. Like, they're going to beat Boston. And he was like, okay. And the crowd was laughing at me. And I was like, you know. And so we're continuing the interview. And I keep looking over at the monitor guy, who's like, I told him to fill me in, right? And I keep looking over at him, and he keeps just going. Like,
those of you who are listening to this, Dallas is shaking his head.
Yeah, like, I'm shaking my head. Yeah. Look at the monitor guy's going, they scored. And then I'm like, okay. Continuing the interview, I keep looking over. He's like shaking his head again, like they scored. And then finally I looked over him and he's like, they tied it. And I was like, and I looked at the crowd and I was like, they tied it. And then I finished there was an intermission. I walked downstairs just as overtime started and just to watch them lose. And then I came back upstairs to finish the interview and I was like,
yeah,
they lost. Like, it was like, in real time, I was like stoked on air about them moving on. And then just like everybody else in the city, I went back on just devastated. And there's somewhere a live performance of me playing a song after that, which with just a little bit more sadness than there usually is in my voice.
The other great story Dallas told was baseball related, and that is that you were in the crowd when Jose Bautista did the bat flip.
Yeah.
And the best story I remember about that was we were doing Wednesday night hockey that night. It was Ottawa at Columbus. So Bautista hits his home run in the seventh inning while we're in the warm-up. And Texas comes to bat in the eighth, down now. So they've already had that great inning where the Jays won the series. I remember I tweeted out, now that nothing else is going to happen in the baseball game, because both games are on our network. So now that nothing else is going to happen in the baseball game, you get ready for Ottawa-Columbus. And people were even tweeting at me from Ottawa going, I'm the biggest Senators fans alive, and I'm not watching this game.
No chance.
I'm watching this game tonight.
No. It was such an interesting thing to be a part of, because I was there with my wife and two of my best friends, and to go from being so confused by the error with the ball hitting the bat, and then I went from this mode of like confusion to like, oh no, now I have to get my wife out of this building. You know what I mean? Safely, because of
they're throwing stuff,
the tension of the building. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking to myself, if they lose this game on this crazy error that no one's ever seen, this is going to be scary. Mm-hmm. And then the elation of when he hits that home run, like, I don't know if that I'll ever experience anything like that ever again.
That was years of not just that baseball team, but that was years of that market's frustration.
Yes.
All coming out in that swing. Mm.
I have had arguments with people, and people will,
it wasn't just baseball. That wasn't just a baseball moment.
I've had arguments with people since, and I'm sure once I say this, people will start being very angry with me. But for my generation, that home run is bigger than the Joe Carter home run.
It's funny. We used to have debates that Alomar's home run was actually bigger than
sure.
Carter's.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because without Alomar, you don't get
to
Carter.
Yeah, they don't.
But for this
there.
Generation, I totally get that.
Because in
I
my
totally
head, it's like, that. Just because I was 12 years old, I saw it happen. It was great. But I was like, you know, they'd won it the year before. And the things at stake, I feel like you said, Jeff, like for the city,
yeah,
for just a fan base who had no sense of victory for so long.
Market had been a punching bag.
It was just a beautiful moment.
Been a punching bag at every single sport for years, and all of it came out on that swing.
It really did.
The swing, the flip, the standing there.
Yeah.
All of it.
There was a beautiful article the next day, and I forget what publication it was in, but it said, Jose Bautista stops Toronto from burning. And I truly believe it. I feel like there would have been some damage done. Instead, I walked outside, and everyone walked outside, and everyone was high-fiving. We didn't win the World Series, but there was just something about that.
So are there many athletes who, NHL players or stuff, that you know are fans of your music or anything like that?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to meet a bunch and become buds with a couple too, which is...
So who is that? Who are we talking about here?
Well, I would say the first guy that I became pals with that realization that a lot of these kids that are from Canada that are younger than me but sort of grew up when my music has been kind of, you know, somewhat prominent,
mm-hmm.
Was Kyle Quincy.
Oh, yeah.
When Quincy
okay.
was playing with the Red Wings, we played, there's a venue there that we play all the time. And the promoter came up to me and said, one of the Red Wings is here. And me and a couple of my guys that tour with me are big sports fans. And especially one of my guys that tours with me is just the most massive hockey fan. And I was like, yeah, bring him up, you know? So Quincy comes back and he's like, you know, we're hanging or whatever. And I'm like, where are you from? And he's like, I'm from Orangeville. And I'm like, Orangeville? And my buddy who's with me, who's the biggest high fan, is also from Orangeville.
No way.
I was like, this is Juice, Quince. Yeah. But so we became good buddies, and I, like, you know, he's, as his journey kind of went on, you know, like when I was living in Nashville, and he came when he was playing with the Devils, I believe, you know, like we went out for dinner. And I guess most recently, like me and Holtby have become pals.
Oh, yeah?
And
how'd that happen?
Again, he's just a kid from rural Saskatchewan who grew up listening to me, and his people got in touch with me one time, like asking if I wanted to come see the Capitals play the Leafs, and I couldn't. Or maybe it was when he was playing for the World Juniors. This was a while ago, but didn't happen. And then months down the line, like our schedules linked up, and we just kind of...
Did you go to a Stanley Cup party?
I didn't, but I don't know if he'd like me telling you this story, but I'm going to tell it anyways.
What's the worst that could happen?
Oh, no, it's just, you know, the Capitals played in Nashville. I have a couple of funny stories about hockey, but... Capitals played in Nashville last year, and it's okay that I can tell the story because they ended up doing okay.
Yeah, okay, absolutely.
So he was like,
things worked out all right.
He was like, I was like, hey man, I'm at home, like I'm in Nashville, I'll come to the game. He's like, I'll leave you tickets. And I had a couple of my guys that had played Alexis on Fire with me staying at my house, so I was like, we'll go see the hockey game. So Holtby leaves us four tickets. We go down and he lets in six goals and is pulled in the middle of the second. And I'm like, oh no, like, do I stay? Like, do I stay and wait to like talk to him after this? You know what I mean? Like, he just, and so we're like, hey, we're going to wait, whatever. And we waited. And then afterwards he comes up and then like, hey, you know, tough game, man. He's like, you know, hockey, win some of this stuff.
Yeah.
He's like, next time I'll put on a better show for you. And I was like, okay, yeah. All right. You're okay with it.
Good.
You got to have amnesia as a goalie. And then, you know,
totally.
A couple months later, he wins the Stanley Cup.
Best guy's parking.
There you go.
Best guy's parking.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he's a great guy, and I've become friends with him and his wife. And he sent me photos of him with the cup in Lloyd Westminster and sitting beside a fire playing acoustic guitar with the cup beside him. And I was like, that's pretty great, man.
I'm sure once upon a time
Did you text back and say, that's pretty good, but I bet you I can play a better acoustic guitar than you?
Yes. Yeah. You stick to your day job.
How hard is it to park a bad show? Not that you've ever had one, but how hard is it?
It's, well...
Like, is that one of the skills you need to develop as a touring musician? Like,
yes.
You know what? I got to put that in rearview mirror.
Yes, I have, I'm a bit of a glass half empty kind of guy already.
Right.
When I have a bad show, it does affect me pretty seriously, but I have learned I need about, and everybody that tours with me now knows that I need about, if I've had a bad show, I need about 30 minutes just to, they call me, my wife gave me the nickname, the Incredible Sulk comes out. So it's like, oh.
You're not the only one.
Yeah, the Incredible Sulk's here. So like everybody just stays away from me. And they came up with this joke where they like pretend to shoot a tranquilizer dart at me, just like put me out for half an hour. Because I just, you know,
That's
it's something
awesome.
I do, and
it's good to
I really want
work.
It. Mm. I want to be good for myself every night. I want it to be, you know, because I'm doing this thing that I love more dearly than anything, and I'm lucky to be able to do that. The thing is, I've had, and not to sound cheesy, but I mean, I'm a songwriter, so I've had life-changing moments on stage. I've had the best moments of my life on stage. So when you don't have that, it can be a little bit disappointing. You know it's not going to happen every night, but knowing that that's possible,
mm-hmm.
you put a lot on your shoulders. But then, like I said earlier, like you know that you just get up and you try it again. And sometimes it works and sometimes it's just okay.
You know, one of the things that really touched a lot of people was your performance of Bob Cajun at the Junos. And I know you're very close with Gord Downie as well. That was a beautiful moment and a beautiful rendition of that song. And a lot of other bands and musicians have covered it. Martin Tielli did a wonderful job of Bob mm-hmm. Cajun as well, of Rio Statics. I know you were close with Gord Downie. That last tour was one of the strongest things I think we've ever seen anyone in this country do.
I don't think you'll ever see it again.
It was remarkable. And I remember that last show was the last day of the Olympics. To me, it's one of those where were you when moments for Canadians. I remember my family was in, my wife and our two kids were in England. I was flying the next day to meet them. Last day of the Olympics, got off set at 5 o'clock and drove home. It was just me and my dog and just sat there with a box of tissues. My mom passed away, brain cancer was small, much like Gord. And it was a strange feeling. It was almost like watching someone perform at what almost felt like his own funeral mm-hmm. in some ways. And to watch like that strength and that grace and that Voltairean smile that he had was remarkable. And yeah. to your earlier point, we're never going to see anything like that again in this country.
No, I don't know if you'll ever see anything like that. And I don't know that we've ever seen anything like that in the history of the world with a band or a group of people and a country. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And mm-hmm. I don't mean to over-dramatize it, but I truly think that there's the relationship they had with the people of this country went so far beyond just the idea of music and listener or musician mm-hmm. and listener. It was, yeah, just something.
Do you have an idea why?
I don't, you know?
Like, I always found the Tragically Hip unique in that, you know, there's, you know, a bunch of guys who look like traditional can rock dudes cranking out, you know, 5 great guys, 3 great chords, 27 great songs. Meanwhile, here's this poet on stage who's singing about Shakespeare mm-hmm. while everyone in the audience is drinking Molson X, wearing beer hats. One of the most unique dynamics of performer band crowd
I think you just said
ever
it.
Seen.
I think it was just a combination of those, of them being able to appeal to just about everyone on some level, whether it was the Molson X hockey fan who loved listening to Gord sing about hockey, or just the kid who loves English and studies poetry.
Yeah.
Gord had the ability to convey all of that in the songs. And the songs were beautifully written. And I think, it was just sort of this perfect concoction of appeal, but beauty. And again, it's one of those things where I feel like the idea of saying it's indescribable is an okay way to explain it, because it's,
I remember reading an interview with Downey once, and he talked about, this was after, I can't remember which album, but he talked about songwriting, and he said, I write in two moods, bloom and brood.
Mm.
And to me, I'll always be haunted by Grace 2. And I'll always love Nautical Disaster because mm-hmm. there's no sing-along chorus to it. It goes from A to B, and there's that story that you follow on. There's no room to pause, and let's all sing a chorus together. It's haunting.
My favorite song is Locked in the Trunk of a Car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's like, there you go. Like, that was a single. Yeah. Think about that. You know,
it's about a relationship, we think. That's the thing about it. Like, there's so many like mysteries and all this.
Yeah.
I keep going back and I have no idea what Grace 2 is about. I'll spend my whole life trying to figure it out.
And that's okay. That's the best part about music. You just take whatever you need from it, you know? Like, I'm a perfect example of it based on the fact that I write songs almost 90% of the time are just about something that's going on in my own head that I need to get myself through. And I do it for myself. But then you just hope that someone else will listen to it and take what they need from it, or they can identify with it, or, you know, like I can write songs about my mother and someone can listen to that and say, that song got me through this. And it's like, they don't know my mother, but just something about the song, they were able to grasp onto it. And I think that's the most beautiful part about music, that it's like that. There's the reason I love sports, is what kind of what I said earlier, is because of the competition, and it's because I love seeing those guys and girls go, I'm better than you. I'm going to prove it right now. Like, I love that. That's also why I love music, for the antithesis of that, is that there's no right, there's no wrong, there's just feeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's something special.
Here's my last question for you. If you could sing the national anthem at just one sporting event, what would it be?
Well, as a lifelong diehard Toronto Raptors fan, I would have to say if the Raptors ever got to the championship.
So they got the NBA final.
They got the NBA final, and there was like a game seven, and it was in Toronto. I would love to sing the national anthem of that. And then hopefully they would win, because if they lost, I would be constantly curse myself that I was the reason.
Okay. We lost it before tip.
Yeah.
The anthem got us.
Yeah. Dallas pulled a Carl Lewis and...
Yeah, you know what? I got news for you. I don't think you're going to do that, you know?
Last one here. If, presto, you're the commissioner of the NHL right now, Dallas, and you could change one thing about the game, what would it be?
Jeez. That's such
at any level, at any
yeah,
level.
Yeah, no, it's such a tough question because...
About how it's played, the culture around it, anything.
Well, I would probably get into trouble by a lot of the fans, but, I mean, I am one of those guys who... Maybe it's because I'm a softy. I still have a hard time with the fighting. You know, I understand. Mm-hmm. I've had friends who were the enforcers
yep.
on the team, but I guess as a mental health guy
mm-hmm.
who, like I said, uses music to get through my own
mm-hmm.
crap and to see what the fighting has done to a lot of those players.
Yep.
I would probably try to do a better job of clearing that up.
I fight with that. Like
I know, me too, because I understand the role. I understand how much it's meant to the game.
As a grown-up, I can't philosophically justify fighting in hockey.
I know.
But sports is what your head knows and what your heart
exactly.
feels.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and there's I'm stuck in between.
I know. It's the idea of being sort of stranded in a tradition or stranded in an old tradition that may not be the right one.
Yeah.
And I think that would be something that I would maybe – but again, it – you know, that's one opinion.
It's funny because on my desk at home, in my home office, I've got Alan Watts again, just a quote. It's actually a Japanese kanji. It says, unlearn something daily. Just something I've always tried to approach every day with. You know, just forget about everything that you know and, you know, be open, you know, be an empty cup. And you can do that intellectually, but I don't know what happens
exactly
when I see two guys drop the gloves at center ice.
Well, that's exactly it, and that's why I'm on the fence of it.
I can't intellectualize
that.
Absolutely. Like, I can't.
You don't know what it's like to be in that position. You don't know what it's like to want to do that for your team. You don't know what it's like to be.
Yeah.
It's easier for us to say, just stop punching each other or stop hitting each other that hard. But it's...
I get it.
You know?
I understand your point of view.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, Dallas, new album coming out.
Yes.
Yes. It's called Guide Me Back Home, and it's I did a really long extensive Canadian tour last year. In a lot of small towns and played all over the place, places I'd never been to, places I'd always driven past and wanted to play. And we recorded every show and then sort of whittled it down to this one live record, trying to represent a song from just about every town.
Mm. Places oh, that's
like
awesome.
Wolfville, Nova Scotia to Surrey, BC to Cornerbrook, Newfoundland. So it's like a love letter to the country and to the people who have given me this opportunity to sing and play my guitar for them.
Nice.
What a perfect way to end it. Dallas, nice. Thanks so much for spending probably more time than you thought. You
oh,
were
no,
with me and Elliot. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me. I always jump at the chance to talk about sports.
What a wonderful conversation with Dallas Green. I want to thank Dallas for stopping by the podcast today. I want to thank Tyler Seguin as well of the Dallas Stars. Our producer, Emil Delich. We want to thank our sponsors as well. And what are your thoughts on our two guests today? Tyler Seguin and Dallas Green. Questions Elliot Friedman never thought would be asked of him.
I think with Seguin, it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, right? So the last thing we asked him about in the interview is the new marketing thing he's going to be doing. And if you're the Dallas Stars, you care more about his hockey now that you've given $80 million to him.
Yeah.
But I think it goes to what we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, and that is that here's a guy who's probably going to step out a little bit, clothing line, stuff like that. Says, I can't beat PK Subban, but maybe I can come in second. I think the game needs that.
You know what?
I'm a big supporter of that.
My 8-year-old. Oh, hold on a second. I've got to talk like a hockey dad. My 2010. my 2010 is a big Tyler Seguin fan. You know
why?
Found him on YouTube on Dude Perfect. It was Jamie Benn and Tyler Seguin as a kid, and they're like doing crazy stuff with hockey and mascots on the ice and shooting donuts and things. And he thought it was the coolest thing in the world. Next thing I know, we're at Pro Hockey Life and he wants a Tyler Seguin t-shirt. And that moment, boom, became a Tyler Seguin fan. Mm-hmm. He's also a right-hand shot too, so he thinks that's cool.
Oh, there you go.
But you're right, like, there are different entry points into hockey.
Absolutely. And, you know, as for Dallas Green, you know, you never know what to expect. It's so funny, like, my wife used to be in entertainment media. And she would say to me, I cannot believe the questions you ask some of these guys. I go, what do you mean?
Do you mean?
She goes, in entertainment media, if you asked anything like sports people ask athletes, we would never get to talk to these guys again. Like, they are the most shielded.
Oh, really?
And oh, yeah. And their publicist can be
so
like.
So are things great or really great? Your thoughts.
That's basically what it comes down to. Like, you cannot ask them.
Good
a
question.
Remote,
I'm going to go with really great, and here's why.
You cannot ask them a remotely tough question. So you never know what you're going to get. The thing with Dallas is, like, you know, I love, like, some of the stuff about Holtby. You know, I mean, the Gord Downie stuff that you asked him was phenomenal. Yeah, the advice he gave to my son about drumming and stuff like that. But also that he's named after Dallas Green. Like,
you love that, don't you?
I love that because I can remember that World Series. Like, I am a huge baseball fan.
Yeah.
I can remember a lot of that World Series like it was yesterday. Like, I loved George Brett. Like, until he ruined the Blue Jays in 1985, I loved George Brett. And Kansas City, one of the famous plays in that series was they hit a pop-up. I can't remember who the Kansas City hitter was. And Bob Boone dropped it, and Pete Rose was backing him up, and he caught it. And I remember that like it was yesterday.
Just crushed.
And Tug McGraw, who was
left-handed pitcher.
Yeah, that's Tim McGraw's dad. And, like, you know, he had names for all of his pitches. Yeah. He had a Bo Derek fastball, and they asked him why he called it Bo Derek. And it's a phrase you can't use now. But I remember that World Series like it was yesterday. And the fact that, you know, he's named after Dallas Green, I love that. And Dallas Green was a big hard ass, too, because that Philly team was tough. It was Pete Rose. It was Mike Schmidt. It was Tug McGraw. It was Steve Carlton. Like, there were a lot of tough personalities on that team. So they needed they fired their previous manager, Paul Owens, because he was too nice. So I'm fascinated by that.
I tried to name our second child after my two favorite characters from Jaws, Sheriff Brody and Quint.
Yeah.
And my wife was having none of it.
Yeah.
So I got Brody, and she compromised with Quinn.
Yeah, there you go.
I got Brody Quinn, but she's like, we're not naming our child after your two favorite characters from Jaws. Sorry.
But Robert Shaw was great in that movie.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, we delivered the bomb.
Season starts next week.
Season starts next week. Big doubleheader on Wednesday. Toronto Maple Leafs and the Montreal Canadiens, followed by the Calgary Flames and the Vancouver Canucks.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
What percentage of words do you think we will combine for on that show working with Doug McClain and Brian Burke?
I'm going to get the welcome back, and we'll be right back, but I think that might be all I get to.
Burkey is going to be at like 63%. Doug is going to be at...
Doug will be right in there.
Doug will be up there.
He'll be defending
his
turf.
He'll be at like 33%.
What I like about that...
I figure you and I will get two each.
I'm telling you, dude. I'm like, welcome back, and we'll be right back. That's all I got. The nice thing about it is, one of the things we never get a chance to hear... This is a failing in media, hockey anyhow. GMs talk to each other.
Yeah.
When do we get it? I mean, you've heard general managers talk to each other, whether it's on draft floor, whether it's various GMs meetings. We never get a chance to do that. We never get a chance to hear that. We will on Wednesday.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. All right. Thanks for the downloads. Thanks for your ears. Much appreciated. We'll talk to you in 7 days when 31 Thoughts, the podcast, returns. Meantime, here is City in Color coming home.
I've been down to Georgia. I've seen the streets in the west. I've been down the 90. Hell, I've seen America's best. I've been through the Rockies, and I've seen Saskatoon. I've driven down the Highway 1, just hoping that I'll see you soon. But I'm coming home. Coming home.